Do we have concepts and ideas to think critically about Russian cultural imperialism? Why is it time to rethink the Slavic or Eurasian studies? You're listening to the Explaining Ukraine podcast. Our guest today is Vitaly Chernetsky, professor of Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Kansas and the current president of the Association for Slavic, East European and Eurasian Studies. My name is Volodymyr Yermolenko. I'm a Ukrainian philosopher, chief editor of Ukraine World and president of Pan Ukraine. Explaining Ukraine is a podcast by Ukraine World, a multilingual website about Ukraine. It is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. You can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front line at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode. So, shall we start? Vitaly Chernetsky, welcome to this podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So let us discuss this very interesting issue of the Ukrainian culture abroad and the presence of the Ukrainian culture, the presence of the Ukrainian literature. Obviously, since the start of the full-scale invasion, the interest to the Ukrainian culture and literature and intellectual history, intellectual traditions have risen in all across the world, and particularly in America. But I still have the impression that the dominant position of the Russian perspective, pro-Russian perspective, or maybe Russia-centered perspective, is still present in Western academia, is still present in many of the American universities, or maybe European universities as well. Will you agree with this?
I would say that overall your estimate of the situation is correct. There are universities that have changed things much more than others. The university where I currently teach, University of Kansas, is one of them, I can proudly say. But overall, it's a patchwork. It all often depends on individual faculty members, sort of one or two people who can start advocating for change. And often then there becomes a critical mass of this kind of support. But we still have a situation where especially a lot of older colleagues are sort of set in their ways, or they feel really unsure and uncomfortable, and they're not sure how to change things, and they still cling to the kind of knowledge, the kind of expertise they received, and unwilling to retool or reorganize or even reframe the kind of approaches that they have had.
Another issue, I think it is very important, that I have the impression sitting in Ukraine and you know reading books about Russia, which are published abroad, and reading other books about colonialism and imperialism in the Western academia, non-Western academia, the academia from non-Western world as well. I have the impression that something which is obvious for Ukrainians, which is obvious probably for Belarusians, for opposition Belarusians, let's say, for Georgians, maybe from people from Kazakhstan or maybe from other countries, that Russia is essentially an imperial power, a colonialist power. And the difference compared to other empires like British or French or Dutch or Belgian is that it continues to be an empire and it wants to re-imperialize the world. It doesn't want to decolonize it. It wants to recolonize it. And I have the impression that we kind of, in academia, in the global academia, we kind of lack a conceptual framework to describe it. We still have so much to do in this field. Do you have this impression as well?
I would say that you are, to a large extent, correct. Again, as we look at the situation, especially in the left-leaning progressive circles in American West European academia, and also in the global South. I mean, those are slightly different, but there is a shared sense there. They know how to critique U.S. imperialism, how to critique the old Western colonial empires, and they were used to thinking of a possibility of another alternative. And to them, the Soviet Union, and they have not really processed the difference between a contemporary Russian Federation and the Soviet Union, was not a real place with real people living, but somewhat an Archimedes point, sort of an abstract construction of a structural difference. And therefore, we had in the Cold War terminology of three worlds theory, and nonsensical binary opposition between the first and the third world. But the very fact that it was called the third world, it means that it's not a binary. So the Soviet Union, and by implication, Russian Empire before it and post-Soviet Russia after it, were given a pass. They are distant, and they often people were at a loss and not sure how to react to that place. And very often were seeking voices to confirm their comfortable belief that, yes, their view of the world could be maintained and in the same way, trying to find voices like that from within the former Soviet space or even the still Soviet space. I remember how excited Western intellectuals were about Boris Kagarlitsky, for example, decades ago, because they found a Soviet or ex-Soviet leftist person who spoke the same language conceptually as a lot of the Western left. And it sort of comforted and reassured them. A different side of things is communication with the global South. And I can speak about that from the experience of my own relatively recent research trip to Brazil and talking to both academic colleagues and people in the street. It was very difficult to explain. I mean, on the one hand, you see even like a street artist, I saw in São Paulo, a painting showing bleeding Ukraine being attacked by Russia. On the other hand, Brazilian universities still have ties to Russia. Brazilian researchers are still traveling to Russia to do archival research now, as if nothing has changed. And they're really is not a change of perspective. A lot of people were expecting that with a change from the Bolsonaro to the Lula government, there will be more understanding and support of Ukraine, and it has not happened somehow or other. Even though Brazil, for example, has a large Ukrainian diaspora, it still maintains this political stance that it's familiar from the old days of Soviet Union's diplomacy towards the then third world. And even though we are in a different geopolitical situation, those old ties, those old habits have proven strangely persistent and enduring. And intellectually, there is not enough still of a presence of Ukrainian culture in those places and Ukrainian thinking, the understanding of Ukraine as an ally and as a place where a lot of very important anti-colonial and decolonial thought was generated over the years.
So indeed, the case of Russia and the case of Soviet Union is difficult to understand for intellectual perspective, because the criticism of colonialism and imperialism comes from the left, obviously, and it comes as early as from Marx himself. And the very concept of imperialism is very much enshrined into the Marxist thinking. And when you see Soviet Union as basically an anti-imperialist empire, and Soviet imperialism, which says we are actually against imperialism and therefore we conduct the most atrocious politics, imperialist politics as possible, it is of course very difficult to grasp, very, very difficult to understand. Unless you understand one important thing in the Russian and then Soviet intellectual tradition, which was very beautifully described by George Orwell when he actually said that, yeah, in this type of thinking, war means peace, and love means hatred, and anti-imperialism means imperialism, etc. I just sometimes think that the way how we describe Holodomor in Ukraine, the way how we describe also famine in Kazakhstan in 30s, which had very much the same umbrella and the same approach of exterminating classes and ethnicities at the same time. So you can describe it in the language of Lebensraum. You can describe it in the language of Nazism. Well, you just eliminate a certain part of population, and then you put into this empty space, a new empty space, basically Russian people, Russian-speaking people from the big cities. So what do you think about the future? What are the concepts? What are the ideas that you think are in the early stage of development, but need to be put forward in order to better describe this phenomenon as Russian imperialism from the 19th century, 20th century, and 21st century?
I think one of the ways through which we can get through a lot of the folks in the Western academia, and especially on the side of the leftist political spectrum, is through the discourse of critical epistemology, the ideas of epistemic injustice, epistemic imperialism, epistemic violence, which accompany the very real physical violence, and the idea that knowing is socially situated and that certain kinds of knowledge is historically privileged, and folks from some subject positions, including collective identity positions, are prevented from sharing their views and knowledge and perspectives. I mean, this is something that has become a rallying cry first in feminist approaches for instance, science research going back to the 1970s, or we can talk about sort of indigenous cultures, Native American perspectives here in the United States. But I think it very much implies to the context of Ukraine and the kind of knowledge it brings. Within the discourse on epistemic injustice, there is a concept that the philosophers call a preemptive testimonial injustice, when it even does not occur to people in the mainstream, in the dominant privileged knower position, to ask for an perspective to be shared from a particular knower, from a particular member of the global community, in this case, I would say Ukraine and Ukrainian culture, because historically it did not even occur to them that they would have anything of value to contribute. For them, there was no there. This is, of course, is beginning to change for very tragic reasons of the Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and its aftermath, but especially Ukraine's heroic resistance and defying all the expectations that Kyiv would fall in 3 days and things of that kind. So some people are beginning to rethink this approach and trying to seek out different perspectives. But there are still others, and this includes folks nominally on the left in the political spectrum who still think in terms of big powers that matter and little countries that do not. So to them, they have the vision of Pax Americana as what they call the sort of the 20th century world order as something that to them is evil and therefore has to be destabilized at all costs. And therefore, they become sympathetic to Putin's Russia or Xi Jinping's China or Iran as countries that are undermining this U.S. dominance, which they know how to criticize, but I don't think they necessarily think through the alternatives that they're trying to propose.
I really like this concept of epistemic injustice, and let me just go a little bit deeper and discuss it with you. What exactly do you mean by that? So do you mean that basically in a certain discussion, the position of a certain group, and we are talking about, let's say, colonized group by the Russian imperialism, be it Ukrainians or somebody else. So the position of this group is a priori not heard and just marginalized and just positioned as inaccurate or biased or non-valuable. So basically, it's a denial of a possibility to know the world from your perspective, and therefore it's epistemic injustice. But also to speak, and therefore it is communicational injustice as a continuation of the epistemic injustice. Is that what you mean?
More or less, yes. Basically, this is a discourse in, primarily in Anglo-American analytical philosophy that has been really booming in the last 15 or so years. I would say the earliest important formulation is the book by Miranda Fricker, Epistemic Injustice, Power and the Ethics of Knowing, which was published by Oxford University Press back in 2007. But a lot more of other colleagues across fields, including now in the fields of East European and Eurasian studies, have started looking at the situation around our part of the world that we live on or that we research through this lens, through this perspective. And basically, yes, this is the shift from the old idea that, you know, a person who learns, the knower, is abstract, isolated, an ideal, and saying that no, all knowledge is socially situated, and therefore there are systemic sometimes problems that prevent certain kind of positions of being heard. So the epistemic agency of some people, individuals or groups are being infringed, thwarted. And so we need a paradigm shift. We need a change in order to recalibrate, reorganize how group knowledge production collectively happens across our planet, so we do not have these prejudiced exclusions, because basically this is a consequence of prejudice, because some of knowers from some perspective is just discounted or dismissed in advance in terms of, you know, because there is a credibility judgment that is not working correctly. And therefore, you need to make an effort. And the question, of course, there is how do we make an effort? Whether we need to convince people who were previously committing the errors of epistemic injustice that they were in the wrong and they need to become more sensitive and more inclusive in approaches, or we need to think about a systemic change of the field as a whole. And basically, probably you need to do both things at once, which in our case of Ukrainian studies and Ukrainian intellectuals and others from the realm of the former colonies of the Russian and Soviet empires is to find allies who can help with explaining this and changing this. And I'm thinking of some colleagues of from Central Asia who are now working in Western academia, like Botakoska Sembekova, who is now the University of Basel in Switzerland. They have really been helping articulate those positions, those views very strongly and powerfully. And hopefully we'll find more allies of this kind who could help our perspective to be heard, because very often there is still a certain identity prejudice that we're dealing with, especially if we're dealing with Western academics of the older generation. This is something that I unfortunately know from personal experience. And I came to the United States at 19 as an exchange student from the then still existing Soviet Union. When people, upon hearing that I was Ukrainian, they trotted out all sorts of offensive stereotypes about all Ukrainians being these rabid nationalists, all Ukrainians being anti-Semitic, all etc. I do not want to voice those offensive stereotypes, but you were basically judged guilty before having a chance to even explain your positionality, your experience, the individual collective traumas you are dealing with, and including the fact that, if we talk about the tragedies of World War II and the Holocaust, I mean, it impacted a lot of Ukrainians, and that some Ukrainians happen to be Jewish, and that Ukrainian and Jewish are not mutually exclusive identities. So, but this is something that has happened quite a bit over the years, and it is less of a problem with the younger generation. So I am optimistic in terms of the generational change in academia, but we still have a lot of hard work ahead of us.
So let us continue to try to conceptualize Russian imperialism, Russian cultural imperialism. Oh, one of the frames of thinking about cultural imperialism is obviously Edward Said, and you know his work also very well, I guess. And I think you contributed a lot to Ukrainian translations of Edward Said. Is it correct?
I helped with the Ukrainian translation of Culture and Imperialism that was published by Kritika. I was the editor of the translation, and I wrote the annotations for most of the volume, about 80% of it. And I worked very actively with Katerina Botanova, who was the translator, to make sure that all the intellectual messages from the book are adequately and effectively rendered in the Ukrainian text.
I actually remember this process of translating, because at that time it was 2000s, and we had a kind of a club in Kyiv in which we would be discussing translations from foreign languages into Ukrainian during the process of them being translated. So Said is obviously very famous for his concept of Orientalism, and the thing is about Russian intellectual tradition that I often hear from the Russian intellectuals, like this, the attempt to apply this framework on them, saying that we were regarded by the West in this Orientalist approach, and even Ukrainians regard Russia through this Orientalist approach. By Orientalism means a certain stereotypization of the East, in a certain way, right? In the way that the East is much richer, that or the East is much more sexual, or the East is utopian, or the East is more violent, etc. But what is lacking in this perspective, I think, is two things. First, that Russia itself has its own orientalism with regard to Central Asia, with regard to obviously the Caucasus. And by the way, it's interesting, and I think you mentioned in one of your interviews that Taras Shevchenko's Caucasus is actually, you can read his poem, which contains the famous phrase "Boritesya poborete." If you read this poem attentively, you will see lots of intellectual ideas that are so much, pre-Saidian, because it is criticizing the idea of civilization bringing violence, etc. But it's 1840s, right, if I'm not mistaken. But at the same time, Russia has something as a mirror reflection of this Orientalism. Let's call it Occidentalism, I don't know. What is the better term? Because it too has this utopian, distorted, funny ideas about the West, and portraying the West in a certain way that created the image of Russian exceptionalism, like we are better than the West because we are the key concept here is of course the concept of duchovnost, the spirituality, like we are more spiritual, Russians are more spiritual than the West. The West is decadent and bourgeois and mechanical, contrary to Russian spirituality, Russian organicism, you name it. And now, of course, it continues because the West is portrayed as LGBT, as gay Europe, and as weak, essentially weak, while Russia is strong. Russia, if you follow right now Russian propaganda, it really reminds of the Nazi propaganda of the 1930s with this idea of Nordic nation, the nation coming from the north and having this strength because it is accustomed of living through the hard times, and but West is hedonistic and relaxant and unable to fight, etc. And I don't know if you advise me some analysis of this Russian Occidentalism? What do you think?
Well, we certainly need to have more of this kind of critical study. I think you pinpointed the problems quite correctly in that, yes, indeed, we have this kind of negative stereotypization of the other, imagined civilizational other as hedonistic and corrupt. I mean, this is a classic Orientalist trope, but it can be projected westward just as it can be projected eastward or north-south. We remember that, there used to be a Rome versus the barbarians supposition, and then as Larry Wolf teaches us, with the imagining Eastern Europe, it changed to an East-West kind of projection. But in general, I would say we have this the pernicious formulation of what Dostoevsky called the universal responsiveness, всемирная отзывчивость, is that Russians have supposedly this unique talent to understand and grasp the essence of each and every culture in the world, and therefore have the right to criticize it, and they themselves cannot be understood by anyone else because they are unique, and therefore it becomes a negative identity in a sense, because it is only defined that we are not those others. And what is that mystery inside of an enigma, to paraphrase Churchill, is emptiness. Oscar Wilde actually has a short story titled The Sphinx Without a Secret, about a person who projected this idea of mystery, and then there was no there. It was all entirely a pose. And this can be said that this is, similar criticism, you know, there is enough internal criticism in, you know, Russian intellectual tradition. I mean, going back to Chadaev, for example. But the problem is indeed that those kind of critical voices are marginalized. And this attractive idea of this deep spirituality as opposed to supposedly spiritually weak or fallen civilization elsewhere has been exploited and used for political advantage. I mean, definitely, I mean, we have geopolitical elements in all of these intellectual debates. So we are dealing with knowledge and questions of intellectual values or questions even of spirituality, if you wish, that are geopolitically instrumentalized by the Russian regime. So, and not only the current one, but this is picking up on the tendencies that have existed there on and off for hundreds of years. So there needs to be more of a critical rethinking of this established pattern. And I am optimistic in that we are beginning to see at least a potential for such a critical rethinking. But things that are obvious to Ukrainians, that are obvious to other former colonies of the Russian and Soviet Empire, require much more of an uphill climb, breaking through to intellectuals especially, but also sort of the broader reading public in other countries.
It's interesting that you evoked Chadaev, because I do think that Chadaev was a person, a promising figure in the Russian intellectual tradition, one of the first real philosophers. And the Russian philosophical tradition didn't take this path that Chadaev has suggested, because it was really the path of self-examination, the path of thinking hugely influenced by the foreign philosophy, in particular the French Catholic philosophy. What happened after Chadaev is that this early debate between the Westernizers, Zapadniki, and the Slavophiles turned into a very interesting thing, which I would say different versions of Russian exclusiveness. Because, of course, Slavophiles like Khomyakov and Aksakov and others were Russian exclusivists. But then if you take the way how the Zapadniki moved, despite what Chadaev suggested, even starting from Herzen and of course then to all this anarchist and socialist and anarchist and communist tradition up until Bolsheviks, they also basically took the path of Russian exclusiveness. And Dostoevsky has a phrase about it, is that even a Russian Westerner coming to the West is actually becoming a Russian exclusivist, saying that no, we in Russia are still better than you are. So, and this is the point of Russian Bolshevism. It's so interesting that the Russian Bolshevism is kind of a victory of the Westernizers over the Slavophiles on the surface, but in the depth, it is the victory of this Russian messianism and the idea of exclusiveness. This is how ideas in Russia are twisted when they actually turn into their contrary. And this is my point. In Russia, you have ideas coming mostly from the West and then turned into the contrary, like communism turned into its opposite. Anti-imperialism turned into its opposite, the Western civilization turned into its opposite, etc. What do you think?
I would say that this is the general tendency. There are, of course, always individuals who try to swim against the tide and who are, at least for a period, being more critical. Herzen was, you know, very, for example, the demise of the Bell as independent press was because it supported Polish struggle for independence, and this was something that proved too much even to the more liberal wing of the Russian reading public, and they stopped supporting, you know, the project economically, and it collapsed. So, you know, we have the Marxist reflections on the Russian imperialism and how even the supposedly leftist visitors to him, they could not fathom Poland, for example, becoming independent again, or things of that kind. So there is this tendency of creating not necessarily even the opposites, but a different version. So, for instance, other empires are evil, our empire is benign. Other colonial practices are to be condemned, but ours are not. I mean, we have this in the 19th century when, for instance, the Russian government on the world stage, it criticized the slave trade, which, I mean, was specifically in the language they used, the trade in Negroes. But at the same time, serfs in Russia continued to be bought and sold. So on the world stage, there was the position, okay, we're going to join the bandwagon with what seems to be the more progressive point of view and use it to our advantage to criticize the slave trade, but we will continue the slave trade that happens in our country internally, because that is all somehow different, and the, you know, the mythology of the well-intentioned landowners, and that the peasants, you know, cannot have agency on their own, and things of that kind. And this perspective on a Russian colonization as something supposedly positive civilizationally, and, you know, getting a pass, is proved to be remarkably enduring. There was recently a good critical essay about this by the American historian Susan Smith Peter, in which she realized that basically the entire school of American historical scholarship on the Russian Empire and its aftermath all comes from people who are just a couple of handshakes away from Vasily Ključevski and from Ključevski's perspectives. So, and that there was never a critical reckoning and a critical examination of that until now. And she herself was very critical towards her own earlier perspectives, but advocated the fact that we do need to have this critical reassessment and the shift of gears and a shift of perspective, because this empire should not escape critical scrutiny any more than the British or the Belgian or the French or the Dutch or the United States.
So the one thing that to my perspective is different in the Russian imperialism compared to the British or French or Belgian is the fact that it was not an overseas empire. It was not a maritime empire. And therefore, it was not colonizing distant people, people distant in culture, in ethnicity, in language, in race, and all other factors. And while for maritime empires, the key concept of domination was the idea of difference. So you are different than me. You will never become the same as me. You are different than me and you are inferior than me. For Russian imperialism, especially with regard to Ukrainians and Belarusians, the approach was different. The approach was, you will never become different than me. You don't have a chance to become different than me. You have to be the same as me. So not the difference, but sameness. The idea of sameness is a tool of domination. And therefore, unless we understand it, we don't understand all the other processes of Russian imperialism, like linguicide, or the approximation of the Ukrainian language towards the Russian language, especially in the 20th century. We don't understand why Russians really were, you know, why Russian Bolsheviks exterminated all the Ukrainian intelligentsia in 1930s. We won't understand the idea of assimilation. We won't understand the fact why Ukrainians, Belarusians, and by the way, Jewish people in the Soviet Union were kind of inclined to change their ethnicity in their passport into Russian. What do you think about this?
I would say that there are two side-by-side events happening. Because on the one hand, if we look at the Russian colonial empire's activity towards Siberia, Central Asia, and Caucasus, we have all the racist othering, we have the anti-indigenous policies that are very much like the Western Empire's colonizations of the North and South America or Africa or Australia. And the patterns are very similar. In fact, Siberia's vast distances make it more remote. I mean, you can think of Goncharov's travel on the Palada ship back in the 19th century. It was easier to sail around Africa to reach the Far East than actually to travel overland. So sometimes being connected by land does not necessarily mean that this is closer. However, we also have this pressure of assimilation and sameness, which can perhaps be compared a little bit to the situation of Scotland and especially Ireland within the British Empire, because we had the strong Irish, you know, independence tradition and the distinct understanding of their culture is different. But we also had the pressure to assimilate, to become the same, the pressure to abandon the language and write in English. Also, the participation in the colonial enterprise elsewhere. Just like you know, people who are Irish could escape prejudice that they experienced if they became colonial officers in India or Africa, and where they were read as quote unquote white, as opposed to being Irish and therefore second class citizens within the British Isles. A similar thing happened to, say, Ukrainians in Central Asia. So a Ukrainian person in Tajikistan would become a quote unquote Russian and be given the privileges that the local people would not necessarily have, especially if this is somebody from the technical intelligentsia. So their empire had these many complicated different mechanisms of how to oppress different groups in a slightly different ways, but this was still a shared continuum of oppression, which from the indigenous population of Siberia or the nations of Central Asia or the Caucasus to Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltics, and others, is that success on the pan-imperial stage required making your distinct identity, culture, language, and other things minor, decorative, basically a secondary sort of empty set of decorations and not something that is profoundly meaningful, that has a different worldview, that has a different knowledge system, that is not second rate, but is actually richer because it brings the perspectives of both the dominant culture and of the oppositional colonized culture. You sort of need to have both, and you have a richer knowledge as opposed to different knowledge.
That's very interesting, and that's really introduces more nuances to our understanding of the Russian colonialism. Well, we are coming to an end of our conversation. There are lots of other topics to discuss, and maybe we will come back with you, because we talk about Russia in this episode, but of course our podcast is about Ukraine, so I would really love to talk with you about Ukrainian intellectual tradition, but that's probably will be the next episode. My last question will be about books. What books would you advise? What recent studies would you advise to go deeper into this topic of Russian imperialism?
There is new writing that is happening and that is ongoing. So there are a lot of things that are in the pipeline that are coming out soon. And for the critical understanding, I would say right now it's more articles than books or even a lot of public work. But I would say a very important part of understanding the imperial nature of Soviet project, looking back at Terry Martin's book, The Formative Action Empire, and also of course, looking at works of literary scholars who looked at a Russian Empire. One of the colleagues that I would think of sort of going back is the book by Harsha Reim, The Imperial Sublime, that looks at 18th, 19th century Russian literature. And there is a lot of that tradition. Miroslav Shkandri's book, Russian Ukrainian Literature and the Discourse of Empire, even though it's more than 20 years old, is still really valuable. Of a more recent works, I would advise looking at the work of Edita Bojanowska, who is teaches at Yale University, and her book on Goncharov, A World of Empires, is really excellent. Or her recent article on Tolstoy as a Russian colonial landlord, because Tolstoy made investment in Bashkortostan lands. Valeria Sobol, who is a Ukrainian-American scholar at the University of Illinois, her book Haunted Empire from 2020 looks at the imperial discourses in Russian literature and culture in the first half of the 19th century in new interesting ways, and it compares both Ukraine as the imagined beautiful South to Finland as the imagined romantic North, because there was also a strong imperialist colonialist discourse towards Finland in Russian culture in the 19th century. And then we have for the Soviet period, I would say there is less of a rethinking that there has been happening, that there could be, but much more can happen, especially in terms of moving from the 1920s indigenization. There's the book by David Brandenburger, National Bolshevism, a Stalinist Mass Culture and the Formation of Modern Russian Identity. Also a book by Yitzhak Brudny on how the combination of imperialist and nationalist attitudes working, and his book Reinventing Russia, I think is a very good case of looking at things from that perspective. But I would say there is a lot of demand and for the outsider views. There is a new book that Erika Marat and Botakos Kasimbekova are working on right now on what they call the concept of Russian imperial innocence. There is a preview article that they have published where they outline the ideas of their larger study, and the presentation, the very presentation of Russian imperialism as somehow innocent of all the evils and faults that we usually assign to other imperialism around the world. So there are things happening. The field is in flux, and I think a lot more new interesting work is going to be coming out shortly. So my advice is please stay tuned, and especially look out for voices of younger scholars, who come from the critical background knowledge from places like Ukraine, like Central Asia, like the Baltics or the Caucasus, who bring the perspectives on Russian imperialism that a lot of the broader public in globally and in the West in particular has been missing.
Vitaly Chernetsky, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
This was a podcast explaining Ukraine by Ukraine World, a multilingual website about Ukraine. My name is Volodymyr Yarmolenko. I am a Ukrainian philosopher, chief editor of Ukraine World, and president of PEN Ukraine. Let me remind you that Ukraine World is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. You can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. You can also support our volunteer trips to the frontline areas at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode. Stay with us and stand with Ukraine.